Reacher nodded beyond the half-open door and said, "Mr. Wiley is in here." The men hung back and let the messenger lead the way. Reacher watched their faces. He saw the truth dawning. An empty space, a dead man on the floor, a lake of drying blood, three unexplained figures standing back from its edge. Not right. Reacher pulled his gun. The two men and the woman turned to look. Reacher said, "You're under arrest." Their reactions differed by gender. Reacher saw a cascade of ancient, hopeless conclusions in the two men's eyes. They were guest workers in a foreign nation. They had no status, no power, no leverage, no rights, no expectations. They were bottom of the pile. They were cannon fodder. They had nothing to lose. They went for their pockets. They scrabbled at puckered fabric, hitching and bending, ramming their hands in, hauling them out. Reacher yelled no in English and nine in German, but they didn't stop. They had weird little sawed-off revolvers, pale steel, pale pinewood grips, barrels about an inch long like stubs. Reacher thought Washington, D.C. and New York and London would be top of the list. Then maybe Tel Aviv and Amsterdam and Madrid. Then Los Angeles and San Francisco, maybe the Golden Gate Bridge itself. Like Helmsworth had said, their orders were to strap it to a bridge support, set the timer, and run like hell. He shot them center mass, a fast double tap left to right, and when they were down, he shot them again, in the head, from the same range, to be completely sure and certain. The shattering noise died away to an ear-damaged hiss. On the side of the empty, broken-down furniture truck, the word Möbel was spattered with blood. Reacher aimed at the messenger's face. The messenger raised her hands. She said, "I surrender." No one answered. She said, "I have good information. I know their bank accounts. I can give you their money." Sinclair took charge. She was the ranking officer, after all, in a NATO kind of a way. From a municipal perspective, Griezmann took it meekly enough, possibly because of Realpolitik, which was a German word for knowing when you're beat. She told him if the van hadn't yet crossed the bridge, he should pull all his men free from the mayor's office and set up a solid perimeter. She sent Nagley to the phone booth to get Bishop on the scene, and White and Vanderbilt. Waterman and Landry could stay home and mind the store. Within minutes, Griezmann had two cars on the bridge. The traffic cop was thanked and sent home. Then two more cars arrived. They funneled through the roadblock and set up ahead of the nearest buildings. Simply a question of numbers. A panel van was a substantial item. A long line of men walking shoulder to shoulder could hardly miss it. Reacher looked at Wiley and then at Sinclair. He asked her, "Did he tell you how he found the crate?" She said,
"Something his Uncle Arnold told him."
"What kind of something?"
"All about the atom bombs. Even Uncle Arnold thought it was crazy, even though he was a paratrooper, and basically everything he was trained for was a suicide mission. He was going to be part of the first wave in the greatest land battle in history. But even so, there was something weird about the atom bombs. Too much power for a single person." Then he told him the story about the missing crate. They all believed it was true. There was panic behind the scenes. Too much for a cover your ass. Uncle Arnold figured the natural ebb and flow would bring it to one particular storage depot. He was sure of it. But it wasn't there. Apparently he took it as a lesson in humility.
What did Wiley take it as?
A lesson in something was labeled wrong.
How did he figure it out?
Something else, Arnold told him. A different subject entirely. Arnold was there very early. Germany was still in ruins. People were starving. The army employed local civilians, mostly women because that's about all there were, like a kind of welfare, and it saved drafting GIs to do shorthand and typing. He put it together with something else Arnold said. The local women would do anything for money, anything for a candy bar or a pack of Luckies. Arnold made hay while the sun shone. One time a girl gave him her sister's address. She was game, too, but he couldn't find the right house. The girl had written 11, and he thought it was 77 because of her handwriting. Europeans put a long tick on the front of their ones, like the opposite of a tail. A one looks like a seven. They put a little crossbar on the seven to make it look different. Eventually, Wiley wondered, what would have happened if a German clerk made a handwritten note and then an American clerk typed it up? Or the other way around? He figured mistakes could be made.
Was it that simple?
He figured surely the army would think of that. He figured they would make charts and tables and change ones for sevens and sevens for ones. But apparently Uncle Arnold's stories were crazy. There was extreme bureaucracy going on. Eventually, Wiley wondered what would happen if a number went through three steps, not two. As in, suppose a German clerk made a handwritten note, and then an American clerk typed it up, and then another German clerk made a handwritten note off the typed-up page, or the other way around, starting with either ones or sevens. He made charts and tables of his own. He figured it was a step the army wouldn't take for itself. He figured the army would be blind to the faults of its own system. And he was right. The crate had been there all along. He found it on his third try. Reacher said nothing, just nodded and walked away. The messenger caught his eye. She said,
I can't help.
He said, I don't want your money. She said,
something else. The fat man is wrong. A van did cross the bridge. It was driving out as we drove in.
Chapter 41. Nagley carried Wiley's bag to the trunk of Griezmann's car, and she set it down on the lid and she unzipped it. Reacher called Griezmann over and asked him to search it. Griezmann said,
"By me?"
Reacher said, "I would appreciate your opinion." Griezmann did the kind of job Reacher expected, like a veteran taking a test, practiced but suddenly cautious, as if he knew something must be wrong. A trap. Was he on trial about how fast he could find it? What was at stake? He didn't know. In the end, only three items were worthy of comment. First was Wiley's new passport in the name of Isaac Herbert Kempner, because it was a thing of beauty. It was completely, utterly, entirely genuine. Second was the map they had seen in his kitchen, now neatly folded, because it was of limited cartographical utility and therefore likely sentimental, which might bring a clue as to his state of mind. Third item was a Mercedes-Benz key, probably not for a sedan, a little too large, too much plastic, too everyday. It was the kind of key that one day would be grimy, the kind of key that came in a panel van. Griezmann agreed. Reacher said,
Can a brand new Mercedes-Benz start without a key?
Griezmann said, No.
Therefore the van was stolen with a duplicate.
Griezmann said, Yes.
Hard to get.
Yes.
Your department has been very impressive since the first moment. Your performance has been excellent. Would you agree?
Modesty forbids.
I mean it sincerely.
Again, I can't comment.
There was only one weak spot. The surveillance south of Hanover never happened.
Such was the traffic division.
They put the car on the bridge for us.
What are you saying?
I'm saying a sequence of events can be explained in a large variety of different ways.
Give me one way, for example.
Everything is a really strange coincidence.
Give me another way.
The police department leaks through the traffic division.
Leaks to who?
Some kind of a mobbed-up community, but not Italian. Nostalgic Germans instead, with members and chapters and rules and all kinds of things, and goals and ambitions. That's what we heard. Griezmann said nothing.
I'm sorry, Reacher said. We're withholding secrets and prying into yours.
Do you have an overall theory?
Only two possibilities. First is they stole the truck from one garage and hid it in another garage about three blocks away.
Why?
For what possible reason? Are they planning to sneak back at night and get it? Is it a double bluff? Is it a triple bluff? It all gets way too weird and complicated. I prefer the second possibility.
Which is?
The cop at the bridge was lying.
That's a big thing to say out loud.
They stole the truck and drove it away. The guy at the bridge turned a blind eye.
These things happen. Get over it. That's what mobbed up means. It's a port. You need to make mental adjustments.
Griezmann didn't answer. Reacher said, it would make sense of what the messenger just told me.
Hardly a reliable witness.
I agree.
Griezmann said,
what is in the truck?
What would you most hate it to be?
One of a number of things.
It's worse than any of them, believe me. Therefore, we need to question everything so we can figure out where to look.
Griezmann said, I suppose a corrupt traffic policeman is a theoretical possibility.
You know these people. You told me you were biding your time. You told me you can't arrest them for thought crimes. You told me you need actual crimes.
Griezmann was quiet a beat. Then he said, I talked to their leader this morning. As a matter of fact, he was the last man to see the forger alive. He wanted Wiley's new name. He had a copy of the sketch. His name is Dremler. He imports shoes from Brazil. I had to go to his office. I couldn't ask him to come to mine. He said he has people in places that would surprise me. He said I was facing a powerful force, soon to get more powerful.
We need to go pay Herr Dremler a visit.
Griezmann drove to a mixed-use street about four blocks from the bar with the varnished wood front. Apparently, neon was permitted in that part of town. Dremler's place was a narrow four-story building, part of the 1950s reconstruction, with a lit-up sign running side to side in the space between the top-floor windows and the rainwater gutter. It was written in red, in a complicated copperplate script, as if it was a famous brand. Like an old-style Coca-Cola sign in America, it said, Schuhe Dremler, which Reacher figured meant Dremler's shoes. The elevator was slow, and the guy wasn't there. His secretary said he had taken a call and gone out. She had no idea where, she had no idea when he would return. They drove back to the consulate. Griezmann was invited in. The others were there before them. Wiley's corpse was en route to the morgue in the American military hospital at Landstuhl in a meat wagon organized by Orozco. The messenger was locked in a basement room, waiting for a U.S. Marshal and a handcuff and an airplane to Dulles.
The Iranian was sitting in a chair by the window. Orozco and his sergeant had brought him in, smooth and easy, no collateral damage. Happily, the Iranian himself had answered the door. After that, it had been a straightforward abduction. The guy looked unsure. His old life was over. His new life was about to begin, in a place he had never seen. Orozco said no one was upset about it. He said Bishop claimed he was about to give the order anyway. The after-action report would be written up accordingly. But he said Bishop had thanked him afterward for saving time, at least. White was happy. He cared about agents in the field. Vanderbilt was gloomier. He said now the CIA in Hamburg was blind. Then Sinclair took the floor. She had spoken to Ratcliffe and the president. All kinds of back channels were open. NATO and the European Union were standing by for a task as yet unspecified. Next step was to fill in the blanks. The U.S. would take a deep breath and admit it had lost track of a crate of nuclear weapons 40 years ago. Germany would take a deep breath and admit it had neo-Nazi gangs strong enough to steal such a crate, which was a step neither the U.S. nor Germany really wanted to take. Neither admission was felt likely to inspire widespread admiration. A final decision would be made soon.
"They want us to fix it for them," Sinclair said, "before soon becomes now."
"Did they say that in words?" Reacher asked.
"The hints were pretty heavy."
"I would like to know for sure."
"I guess some questions are better answered afterward."
"How long have we got?"
"They can't wait forever."
Outside the window it was going dark. Northern latitude, late afternoon. Reacher asked, "How big of a deal is Dremler's shoes?"
Griezmann said, "He boasts of 1 million pairs a week, 50 million pairs a year. Probably bullshit, but even so, I'm sure it's a large number."
"So the office we saw must be clerical only. Orders and invoices and that kind of thing. The heavy lifting must get done elsewhere."
"At the docks," Griezmann said. "He owns part of a wharf."
"And he has people in places that would surprise you."
Sinclair said,
"Is this a Hail Mary?"
"No, ma'am," Reacher said. "It's a wild-ass guess."
"About the shoe guy?"
"At first, as a theoretical example. Let's say he's the grand wizard of something or other. He's got members everywhere, including the police department. As a result, he's been with us every step of the way. He heard about the deal back at the beginning. Then he decided to hijack it. For the greater glory of whatever it is he's the grand wizard of, he piggybacked on our investigation, and it worked for him. He got the van. But it was a crazy scramble. He was always short of time, always playing catch-up. He couldn't plan ahead, no further than getting it out. Now he doesn't know what to do with it. He doesn't even know what's in it. That information never leaked. I think he stashed it somewhere close, temporarily. He needs to take a deep breath. He needs to figure it out."
"Plausible," Sinclair said. "But so are 100 other possibilities."
"Not 100, Reacher said. 10, maybe. But this one fits what we know."
Dremler asked the forger about Wiley's new name. That can't be a coincidence. And he owns a wharf. 1 million pairs of shoes a week? That's a lot of trucks. An extra one wouldn't be noticed.
"We get only one shot at this."
He remembered moving his other hand the same way, barely touching her forehead, burying his fingers deep in her hair, pushing them through. That time he had left his hand where it ended up, which was cupped on the back of her neck, which he remembered felt slender and warm. He had gambled then. He said,
Your call.
You don't have an opinion?
I'm going anyway, just in case. Because if this is the guy, this is also the guy who got his ego in a wad when his junior varsity got beat. Ever since then, he's been setting people on me. I left word he should come out and meet me himself. I told him we could walk around the block and have a discussion. Maybe it's time to make that happen. Chapter 42. They waited for full darkness to fall, and for rush hour traffic to die away, and for all kinds of diplomatic discussions to be over. Bishop said he had to be there. He would drive White and Vanderbilt in his car. Sinclair said she would join them. Griezmann felt he should observe on behalf of the city. He was happy to invite Waterman and Landry to ride with him. They were FBI, after all. It would be an honor. Reacher and Nagley would go with Orozco, in Orozco's car, driven by his sergeant, who was a guy named Hooper. He was taller than Nagley, but not a huge guy. He and Orozco had army berettas. Reacher had a new mag in his Colt. He had been four rounds down. Griezmann led the convoy. He had local knowledge. He took the scenic route. The city got serious as the docks approached. It got fast and efficient and hard at work, lit up bright and crawling with movement. There were acres of stacked containers and miles of cranes and queuing semis. There were huge metal sheds, one after another, some with names Reacher knew and some he didn't. They moved on, and mile by mile, they saw the same kind of things again and again. Then they saw a huge metal shed, fat and bulbous in a modern way, with a blazing red old-style neon sign on its roof, on an old-style iron frame, way up high, written in a copperplate script, like an old-time Coca-Cola sign. It said, Schuhe Dremler, which meant Dremler's shoes. Griezmann dropped his speed and they drove past, going slow. The place was lit up like a stadium. On the other side of the shed was the wharf. Presumably, shoes came off the ships into the shed from the far side, into some kind of a routing or packing or inventory system, and then out of the shed again on the roadside, where the trucks were loaded for onward delivery. 1,000,000 pairs a week. Which clearly required an evening shift, but maybe not a full contingent. The place looked to be working about half capacity, maybe a little more. Orozco said, "You sure it's in there?" Reacher said, "What part of wild-ass guess didn't you get? Are we going to wait for later? They might work all night. There could be 50 people there. With jobs to do, we could be 100 yards away. They won't pay attention. The truck might have a guard detail, but there are 4 of us. It's a done deal. If he's there." They stopped the cars 2 units further on and got out in the damp nighttime air. Sinclair said, "Are the missing items recognizable for what they are?" "I never saw one," Reacher said. "But from what Helmsworth told us, they're 50-pound metal cylinders in canvas backpacks. They could be anything."
"Do they have writing on them?"
"I'm sure they have codes for serial number and date of manufacture, but not like the back of a car. It won't say what it is."
"Which is why they're not panicking yet."
"Unless they found the code book. That might give them a clue."
"It's in code.
Like the man said. Think about D-Day. I'm sure it's easy to follow along."
"It's a warehouse full of shoes. I think you guessed wrong. It's surreal."
"So is strapping an atom bomb to a bridge support and running like hell."
"That was then."
"They don't know what they got. They were hoping for machine guns, maybe grenades. They're scratching their heads in there.
It's one possibility, but we only get one chance at this.
Then let's hope it's the right possibility.
But is it?
Let's ask Griezmann's opinion, Reacher said. Griezmann shrugged. In his opinion, Dremler was a bold and ambitious shit-stirrer and rabble-rouser. The man was a lover of history, and of movements and causes, and of the power accrued by great men who strike when the time is right. Griezmann thought one day he might be very dangerous, but so far he was all talk and no action, thus inexperienced, thus likely to be overwhelmed by his first major project. No one ever plans for afterward. Thus it was plausible he would pause for breath, in a place of safety. Therefore, it was plausible he would choose his own premises. In fact, more than plausible, a virtual certainty, he would be in control there. Human nature.
If it's him, Sinclair said.
Reacher said, there's only one way to know for sure. There was no point in attempted concealment. The dock road was brightly lit. The truck-loading areas were brightly lit. The metal sheds were brightly lit. Beyond them, the wharf was brightly lit. The only darkness was the water. They turned around in the road and drove back to Dremler's shoes. First Griezmann and then Bishop slowed and stopped at the curb. Orozco's guy, Hooper, leapfrogged them and drove straight ahead, level with the red neon sign, to the main gate. He turned in. Up close, the shed was enormous, some kind of glittery, galvanized metal, no slits or windows or portholes. The roof was bigger than the walls, swelled up and bulbous like a loaf of country bread, like a bouffant hairstyle. It was ribbed and stressed and physically complex. Below it, the walls looked short. The wall facing the yard had about 50 vehicle entrances, roll-up doors like suburban garages, but bigger, in primary colors, with plastic porthole windows. Light blazed out. Maybe 30 doors were open in an orderly line from the left, reaching beyond halfway. The first 20 or so were busy. Trucks were driving in and out. Then 10 doors were open, but apparently idle. On the right, the last 20 were closed up tight. The evening shift. Maybe rush orders only. They drove closer. Inside, the shed was as big as a football stadium. There were rushing conveyors and piles of boxes rising to immense heights and bustling forklift trucks. And noise, apparently. The guys inside were wearing big yellow ear defenders, which might help. Reacher said, they were paratrooper weapons. Immediate ground combat was anticipated. Therefore, stray rounds passing through the backpacks must have been predicted, so they probably don't explode from that. Almost certainly not. But if possible, I would prefer not to test that theory.
If it's in there, Orozco said, let's go find out.
Hooper drove in through the last of the open but idle doors and turned right, away from the busy end of the warehouse toward the quiet end, in a vehicle channel marked out with tape. He drove behind the line of closed doors and braked and stopped, and Nagley got out. He drove on and braked again, and Orozco got out. He drove on and braked for a third time, and Reacher got out. Reacher stood and watched Hooper drive away. First thing that hit him was the noise. The conveyors were howling and squealing and rattling. The forklifts were chugging and beeping. The second thing was the smell. A million pairs of new shoes. Like a childhood memory, like a shoe store on Main Street,
but 1,000 times stronger. Behind him, none of the trucks was a panel van. Ahead of him, nothing was moving. Nothing was parked. No vehicles were visible. He could see all the way out to the wharf. A long distance, but a clear view. The lights were bright. Nothing there. But there were mountains of boxes, many different places. The smallest was taller than Kansas. The biggest was immense, jagged like the Rockies from a distance. A left-to-right panorama, near the end wall, but not on the end wall. There was space behind it. Not much, visually, against the hugeness all around. But up close and human, it might be a useful slice, maybe as wide as a vehicle. Reacher looked back. There were maybe 50 guys working. They were suited up like football players, in high-visibility overalls and hard hats and ear defenders, with plastic cups over their knees and elbows like the airport workers. Most were putting their time in. A couple were standing and staring, unsure. Reacher waved. They waved back and turned away. An old lesson. Act like you belong there, like you just bought half the company. Meet the new boss. Reacher turned back. 50 yards ahead, Hooper had pulled over. He was waiting. Roscoe arrived at Reacher's elbow, then Nagley. They had to talk loud because of the noise. Roscoe said, "Either it's hidden behind the boxes or it ain't here at all." "No shit, Sherlock. Argument against would be that's a lot of boxes to stack on a moment's notice." "I think they're permanent," Nagley said. "I think the office must be back there. I don't see it anyplace else. They walled themselves off. Peace, quiet, and parking spaces." They walked closer. The smell was intense, like walking through a department store. The mountain range of boxes was set end on to the last but one roll-up door, blocking it completely, which meant the very last roll-up door was the office staff's private driveway, just like the Army. They detoured to door number 47 to see how it worked. The good news was it had manual override, an up button and a down button, both plastic, both brightly colored, both the size of a saucer, like my first magic mushrooms. The bad news was they were on a panel on the left of the door, the far side of the lane, the rear corner of the commandeered space. Roscoe said, "It could be parked facing out, like a fire engine. It could be out of here in a second. If it moves, shoot the tires." Reacher said, "If it moves, shoot the driver. The Davy Crockett's are about 2 feet tall. Headshots should be safe enough." "If it's there." Reacher remembered Sinclair's hand on his chest. A stop sign. But no. An assessment. And then a conclusion. Not remotely trust or even confidence or much interest, but a solid gamble. He was worth taking a chance on. "Yes," he said, "if it's there." Chapter 43. It was there. Reacher peered around the last corner of the mountain range, one eye only, and he saw the panel van, no longer white, now daubed with imitation graffiti, with balloon-like letters, W and H and S and L. It was facing out. Its rear door was up. Inside were stout canvas packs, covered with straps, padded and round, in camouflage colors that were still dark and strong. They had never seen the light of day. To the left of the truck was a wall of windows, into a large but empty office room. To the right was the back face of the mountain range, maybe 3 feet of space either side of the truck, not cramped at all. Up close,
The area felt generous. There were no people in sight, no guards. Reacher pulled back and checked the other way. Another two workers were standing and staring. He stepped back to where Orozco and Nagley were waiting. Hooper was there. He told them the news. They took a look for themselves, one at a time, one eye only. Orozco stepped back and said, "The office suite must be two rooms deep. They must be in the rear section." Reacher said, "Or they went out to get pizza and a pitcher of beer. Why stand guard over a bunch of tin cans? They don't know what they've got. First priority is the panel van, not the personnel." "Agreed," Reacher said. "So let's go steal it back. Right now. We have a key, like boosting it off the curb while the owner is inside watching the ball game." Reacher nodded. One time he had rotated through an army fight school where the toughest instructor liked to say the best fights are the fights you don't have. No risk of defeat, no risk of injury, however slight or unlikely. Plus, in this case, a political dimension. If the van just disappeared, who could say it ever existed? Deniability was always useful. It would fit the narrative. What crate? Clearly the noisiest element would be raising the warehouse door. It was driven by an electric motor through chains, long and slow. It would need to open all the way. It was a high-roof van. 30 seconds, probably. Grinding, rattling, shuffling upward. A very characteristic sound, like putting a notice in the newspaper. They would come running at once. Better to back it out, the other way. Reverse it carefully, deep toward the center of the shed as far as possible, and then swing it around and escape through the body of the warehouse, through the nearest of the open doors, the same way Hooper drove in. Now, 70 yards away, four workers were standing and staring. Reacher said, "Okay, let's do it. Who wants to drive?" Nagley said,
"I will."
"If they hear the engine, they'll approach on your side, so you'll need cover, but not from the passenger seat. You could get shot in the face. I'll walk on the blind side. When you stop reversing, I'll jump in and you can take off forward. Then Hooper and Orozco can tuck in behind."
"I plan on reversing faster than you can walk. They're paratrooper weapons. They can stand a little slamming around. Sit in the passenger seat. Just don't do the part where you shoot me in the face. It's not complicated."
Reacher glanced the other way, still four workers watching. "Brisk," he said, "not crazy. Make it look like regular business. It drove in, and now it's driving out again." He peered around the corner one last time, both eyes. The windows? Blank. The truck? Waiting. Nothing else. No people. Now there were six workers watching. They had moved up a step into a loose arrowhead. The nearest guy was 60 yards away, isolated by distance and noise, but staring. Reacher gave Nagley the key. He said, "Go for it." Orozco and Hooper drifted back toward their blue opal. They got in and moved it to where they could see into the hidden bay, obliquely, for mission support, but where they wouldn't impede Nagley's rearward progress. They left space for her to back up alongside them. Then she would pull forward on full lock and turn tight in front of them and drive away. They would fall in close behind on the same curve. Nagley checked the view and took a breath and stepped into the hidden bay. Reacher followed. She walked down the blind side of the van to the passenger door. He paused near the tailgate. He watched the office windows. She tried the passenger door. It was unlocked. She opened it wide and climbed across to the driver's seat. He stretched up tall and caught the strap and inched the rear door down. "There are paratrooper weapons. They can stand a little slamming around." "Maybe so. but he didn't want them spilling out during a violent maneuver. He didn't want them rolling and bouncing across a Hamburg street corner. He tugged on the strap, and the door came down, quiet and slow and easy, whirring and spooling on nylon bearings. A foot and a half, 2 feet. He stopped. Shit. He caught Nagley's eye in the mirror and chopped his hand across his throat. Abort. Now. She climbed out over the passenger seat, out the passenger door, along the painted plank. She followed him back to safety. Orozco and Hooper came back from their car. In the other direction, a dozen workers were watching. A whole regular crowd, still a shambling arrowhead, 50 yards away, shuffling closer. Nagley said, "What happened?" "Should be 10 bombs in the truck," Reacher said, "but I only counted 9. Hooper and Reacher had never met before, so Reacher was sure Hooper wouldn't say it, or Orozco. Too much old-world courtesy. It would be Nagley who said it. She would assemble a dozen alternative theories, starting with ships sailing back to Brazil or with trucks rolling on to Berlin, and then ending either with successful resolutions or with blast zones and fireballs and 1 million dead. All depending on one critical question, which she would ask. She said, "Are you sure you counted right?" He smiled. "Let's use the 2 personnel rule," he said. "Basic nuclear safeguard. Hooper should go. He hardly knows me. He's still an unbiased observer." So Hooper went. He checked from the corner, one eye, very carefully, and then he stepped into the hidden bay. Reacher replaced him at the corner, one eye, and saw him at the tailgate. He was too short. The height of the load floor, plus a couple of feet to the top of the backpacks, meant he was looking up at the front rank only. Then Reacher saw a man in the corner of the office room, on the right, in the far back, on an exact diagonal from where Reacher was. Which meant the guy couldn't see Hooper. Not yet. The angle was wrong. The corner of the truck was in the way. The guy in the room moved. He was looking for something. He was going from desk to desk, opening drawers, stirring a thick finger through, moving on. He was a big guy. He looked competent. Hooper stepped back and went up on tiptoe. The guy moved on, the length of a desk. Now the angle was right. The noise was loud, howling, squealing, rattling, chugging, and beeping. Reacher called, "Hooper, get in the van!" Loud enough to be heard, he hoped, by one and not the other. Hooper froze for a split second, and then he vaulted up on open palms and scrambled over the backpacks into the shadows. The guy in the office looked out the window. He took a step closer. He checked the van. He checked the space behind the van. He watched for a moment. Then he turned and walked away, to the far back corner again, and through a door, to the hidden part of the suite. Reacher waited. The guy didn't come back. Not in 1 minute. Not in 2. Which he would, if he had heard. Human nature. He would have grabbed his guns and his buddies and come back right away. He hadn't heard. Reacher called, "All clear, Hooper." No response. Howling, squealing, rattling. Reacher called again, louder this time. "Hooper, all clear." Hooper stuck his head out the back of the truck. Then he jumped down and bounced up and walked back to safety. 9 bombs. He said. "The code book is missing, too." Chapter 44 In the other direction, the crowd had grown to about 20 strong, and they were 40 yards away, still tiny in the industrial vastness, not threatening. Reacher felt the opposite was true.
They were standing up in puzzled solidarity against what they saw as a threat against their bosses in the office. They were ready to close ranks against the intruders. They were loyal employees, or more. Maybe some of them were low-level members of the cause. Maybe that's how a guy got a foreman's position at Schuhe Dremler. Reacher said to Hooper, "How good is your German?"
"Pretty good," Hooper said. "That's why I work here."
"Go tell them to calm down and get back to work." "Any particular form of words you want me to use?" "Tell them we're American military police, here on behalf of the Brazilian military police, conducting a routine audit connected to shoes, and if we're forced to report a hostile reception, they'll get extra scrutiny."
"Will they believe me?"
"Depends how convincing you are." They watched him, 40 yards away, face to face with the guy at the tip of the arrowhead. He was talking in long, composed sentences. The crowd wasn't buying what he was selling.
Orozco said, "Stand by to rescue him."
Reacher said, "Don't kick them in the knees."
"Why not?
They're wearing knee pads." Hooper kept on talking and talking. Forward motion ebbed away. The crowd went still, but not convinced. Hooper took the long walk back. He said,
"I did my best."
"Are they going to call the cops?" Reacher said.
"Not their place. They're confused, is all. And concerned. It's a family business."
"Then we better be quick."
"Where do we start?"
"With data, which means the office and the guy in it."
"Rules of engagement?"
"We'll figure them out afterward."
They did no more one-eye checking, too much scrutiny. Didn't look right. Instead, they walked around the pile of boxes, brisk and routine, into the hidden bay as if all they needed was a signature on their paperwork, or an answer to a supplementary question, or a copy of a document. They pulled their guns as soon as they were out of sight. The entrance to the office suite was a door in the far back corner of the space, beyond the van, near the manual panel for the roll-up exit. The door led to the first room, which had a matching door in the far back corner, which led onward to wherever the guy had gone, to the rear part of the suite, presumably unknown territory. Opening the door let in a pulse of factory noise, so they got through fast and fanned out ready. Hooper walked backward. He was tasked to be eyes on rearward at all times. Essential for confidence. Nothing worse than not knowing what was behind. The crowd could get restless again. Reinforcements could show up. The night shift, reporting early. Or expert opinion. German army veterans, maybe, called in especially and asked a simple question. What the hell are these? They didn't know what they got. They moved on toward the next door. It was narrow, a bottleneck, what stun grenades were invented for. But they had none. The door was open a crack. Reacher peered through, saw nothing, a slice of empty room. He put his ear to the opening. He heard talking in German, male voices, questions and answers, frustrated but not angry, puzzled but patient. They were trying to figure something out. Three guys talking, Reacher thought. Were there others saying nothing? The sound was off to the left, and it had a boxed-in, glassy tone, as if they were in a walled-off executive office in the left-hand corner, which he couldn't see. He backed off a step, glanced out the window. No one was coming after them. Not yet. He made hand signals. Minimum three people located far left in the corner. They paced out, back to back on their side of the dividing wall. It was an awkward distance, two steps too long for total surprise. Hooper would guard the door facing out,
and first Nagley, and then Reacher and Orozco would go deep, fanning out, splitting the target, giving three different lines of sight. Any monkey business? Waste all but one. They took up station in operational order. First Nagley, then Reacher, then Orozco, then Hooper facing backward. Nagley burst through the door and headed for third. Reacher took second. Orozco stopped at first. Where home plate should have been was a glassed-in cubicle, set up like an office within an office. Flanking the desk were two guys. One was the man Reacher had seen before, a big guy and competent. The other was similar. Propped in a chair in front of the desk was the tenth Davy Crockett. Like a human visitor, like a suspect in a police station, its canvas pack was unlaced and pulled down. The cylinder was dull green. It had white stencil writing. It had a screwed-on panel up top with six small chicken-head knobs and three small toggle switches. Behind the desk, in a chair, was a guy Reacher took to be Dremler. He looked like the boss of something. He looked like a leader. He was about 45 years old, an imposing individual. His hair was blonde, going gray, and his face was red, going gray. He was wearing a suit with a high lapel, an old German style. His elbows were on the desk, his fingers were steepled. He was studying the secret file, or he had been. Now he was staring at Reacher, or his Colt government model, which was aimed at his face. Reacher said, "On the hook," like an old black-and-white movie, hands up. Dremler did nothing. The men either side went for the biding-his-time tough-guy version, their hands coming up halfway, fingers straight, tense and speculative. A ceasefire, but not a surrender. Reacher stepped closer. He said, "You speak English?" Dremler said,
"Yes."
"You're under arrest."
"On what authority?"
"The U.S. Army." Dremler glanced down at the crumpled camouflage canvas. Reacher said, "Did you mess with that thing?"
"Not yet," Dremler said. "We don't know what it is." "It's nothing of interest. We clicked the knobs a little to see what they were, really."
"And the switches?"
"On and off, a couple of times."
"And now you're studying the file, trying to puzzle it out."
"What is it?"
"Exactly," Reacher said. "Step out of the room, one by one." The first guy came out, the man Reacher had seen. He walked on his toes, tense and ready, biding his time. Then the second guy came out just the same. Reacher said to Dremler, "You stay there." Dremler stayed at his desk, his fingers still steepled. Reacher said to the two guys, "You are in the custody of the United States Army. I am obliged by law to tell you if you mess with us, we will hurt you very badly." The two men didn't move. Reacher said to Orozco, "You and Hooper take these guys out to Griezmann. Send Nagley out to guard the truck. New departure time is 15 minutes from now." "Why?" "He messed with the switches."
"It has to need more than that."
"I sure hope so, but I would like to check. Herr Dremler can help me. He has the file, after all." Chapter 45. Dremler stayed at his desk, and Reacher sat in an empty chair next to the Davy Crockett, like a host and two guests, a three-way conversation. Three points of view. But nothing was said. Not for the first many minutes. Reacher took the file off the desk and tried to make sense of it. A six-digit code was entered by turning the chicken head knobs. Officially, one guy did three digits and clicked his arming switch, and then the second guy did three more and clicked his arming switch. The center switch stayed off. What was it for? The file didn't say. 10 6-digit codes were listed. They were indexed against 10 serial numbers, ready for an armorer's stick of chalk. Dremler said,
"What is that thing?"
Reacher said, "What were you hoping for?"
"I don't know what you mean."
"To help your cause make a statement?"
"You should leave now," Dremler said. "This discussion is over."
Reacher said,
"Is it?" "You have no authority here. This is a simple misunderstanding. I don't even know what that thing is."
"It's a bomb. You stole it after asking about Horace Wiley's new name."
"Griezmann would find it very difficult to make legal progress against me."
"Because you have people in places that might surprise him?"
"Hundreds and hundreds of people."
"Are you their leader?"
"I have that honor."
"Where are you leading them?"
"So they want their country back. I will make sure they get it. And more. I'll make sure they get the country they deserve.
Strong, again, with purity of purpose, all pulling together in the same direction. No more dead wood. No more outside interference. Nothing of that kind will be tolerated. Germany will be for Germans."
Richard was quiet a long moment. Then he said,
"How much do you know about the history of your country?"
"The truth or the lies?"
"The terror and the misery and the 80 million dead. We learned that stuff in class. Then at night, we'd be shooting the shit and someone would talk about a time machine, which meant you could go back and take the guy out before he even got started. Would you do it?"
"What was your opinion?"
"I was all for it. But it was a dumb question. There are no time machines. And hindsight is always 20/20 vision. I figured the real challenge was to ask the question backward, starting in the here and now, looking ahead with foresight, which is the opposite of a time machine. Is there a guy you could take out today so no one would need to dream about time machines tomorrow? If so, would you do it? Suppose you were wrong. But suppose you were right. 80 million lives for one."
The clock in his head told him 15 minutes had passed. The bomb was fine. Random twisting and clicking meant nothing. Which made sense. A bad parachute landing could have been worse. He said,
"It was a hardcore moral question. Some said no, because the guy has broken no laws. Not yet. But that was true of all of them once. If you would come back in a time machine to do it, why wouldn't you do it now? Some worried about degrees of certainty. What if you're only 90% sure? Some said better safe than sorry, which logically meant anything better than 50%, but not really. Anything over 1% might be worth it. A 1 in 100 chance of saving 80 million people from terror and misery? Do you have a view, Ed Dremler?"
Dremler said nothing.
Reacher said, "We were undergraduates. West Point is a college. It's the kind of thing we talked about then. Were we serious?"
"Didn't matter. There was no way to prove we would do what we said. Or not. But life's a bitch. Now I get to answer the question for real. Was I bullshitting all those years ago?"
He shot Dremler in the heart, and when he settled, he shot him again, in the head, from the same range, to be sure and certain.
Then he put his gun in his pocket and stuffed the file in the camouflaged backpack and hoisted the Davy Crockett up on his shoulder and walked out to the van. He stepped one way and hit the green